All right, well, we're going to go ahead and get started. We are starting the book of what in here? The book of wilderness. The wilderness. Remember, we're using the Hebrew name because it's more fun than Numbers. Numbers is kind of boring. I'm not naysaying the Bible anyway. That title was man-made. It wasn't given by God. The Hebrews call it the book of the wilderness. What happens in general, we talked overview-wise, who wrote the book of Numbers or wilderness?
Moses.
All right. And it's part of what's called the Pentateuch or the Torah, the law. And as we look at this book, what period are we covering? Do you remember? What period of time are we covering for the Hebrew people? The Exodus was a time when they did what? They exited. I love that title. It's a very good title. Exodus. They left Egypt. And at the end of Exodus, we're at the base of Mount Sinai, okay? And so there also where we're given the book of Leviticus, the giving of the law. Moses goes up on the mountain, comes back all glowing with the presence of God, and, you know, that ensues as far as what happens there at the end of Exodus. Numbers gives us the time when they're in the wilderness. See how that helps? The title helps. So this is the wilderness period. It covers about 39 years. Okay, now the first 10 chapters covers 19 days. The first 10 chapters covers about 19 days. And Numbers, or the book of wilderness, is nice in that it gives us, you know, little dates and things like that as it goes along, little checkpoints in time, so we kind of know time period-wise what's happening. And as we went into Numbers, I wanted to recover a few chapter 2 just briefly because it's going to play a big part in what happens later on in our march and things as we go through the book. But in chapter 2, we have the arrangement of the camps. But it gives us more than just the arrangement. If you remember, they would camp around what? What was the center presence of the camp? The temple, the tabernacle, right? The tent. That big tent, okay? And the big tent represented what? The presence of whom? God. And they actually could see the presence of God because they were led by a cloud, right? So they could see the very presence of God in the very center. And so that as a camp, they camped around this tabernacle or the tent. And chapter 2 gives us how they divide that out. If you look over here in chapter 2, I believe in verse 3, now, those who camp on the east side toward the sunrise shall be the standard of the camp of Judah. Okay, this is a camp. And in this camp, we have Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. All right, you have those three tribes are in the camp of Judah, and they're camping eastward. All right, and then as we look, the leader of the sons of Zebulun, Eliab, the son of Helon, and his army, and so it gives us. And then there's an interesting phrase here at the end of verse 9, they shall set out first. What do you think that has to do with? They shall set out first. When they move, exactly. When they leave the camp of Judah, that's camped towards the east, they march first. So it gives us not only their camping order, but it gives us their marching orders also. And then on the south side, in verse 10, shall be the standard of the camp of Reuben. And with Reuben, we have Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. And then at the end of verse 16, we have, and they shall set out second. They shall set out second. And then here in this verse 17, we have a little, the tent of the meeting shall set out with the camp of the Levites in the midst of the camps, just as they camp. So they shall set out, every man in his place by their standards. And so the Levites march in the middle of the column also. You see how that plays? The figure that's there? What's also interesting is, remember the tabernacle, how it's open? Where is the door? On which side is the door? The entrance into the tabernacle, into the Holy of Holies, which side is that? East. Who's camping on the east side? Judah. Who comes from the tribe of Judah? Christ. Also, the priests camp near the door, near on the east side. All of the tribe of Levite camps around tribe of Levi camps around the tabernacle, but the priests, the ones that serve as priests, camp on the east side near the door. It's a closer commute to work. But as far as like the imagery there, you go through them to get to God. Does that make sense? And so the imagery is pretty neat. But when they walk with them in the very center. And so on the west side, you have the camp of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Benjamin. And they set out third. And on the north side, you have the camp of Dan, Asher, and Naphtali, and they shall set out last. Now, you know, we talked about there's over 600,000 people. Does not include women and children, does not include animals and things of that nature. And you're at the back of the column. How many of you ever have driven down a dirt road with your windows open? And you're the first person. And you have a car in front of you and you try and roll down your windows? That's not very fun, is it? A little bit of dust. I don't think I'd want to be in the camp of Dan, personally. But they set out. And if you imagine all these people setting out, we're going to talk about how this gets organized. But it's going to take a while. It's not like you just, load up the RV and that kind of stuff. You know, you got to pack up, pull the stakes out. Anybody pulled stakes out of the ground before? That's so annoying. Florida, not so much. You guys have it easy. It's like sand, unless you go down to the Keys and it's like rock. But other than that, it's sand. But, you know, just all the details that go into putting camp together. Now, let's fast forward. We've gone through everything, and I told you we talk about ox carts in chapter 7. I wanted to cover just briefly chapter 2 again because it's going to play a part in what's going to happen next in the next few chapters. And so we're still here at the base of Mount Sinai. We haven't left. We're covering this 19-day period. These are all preparatory things for this leaving of Sinai, okay? They've been here for a while, almost a year at Sinai. And so here we are. Now, on the day that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, he had anointed it and consecrated it with all its furnishings. This is chapter 7, verse 1. And they consecrated all everything. Now, the leaders had to give an offering. And here we have the carts. And the leaders of Israel, the heads of their fathers and households, made an offering. They were the leaders of the tribes. In verse 3, when they brought their offering before the Lord, 6 covered carts, 12 oxen, a cart for every 2 of the leaders, and one and an ox for each one. And so here they present 6 carts and oxen to the tribe of Levi. Down at verse 6, so Moses took the carts and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. 2 carts and 4 oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon, according to their service. And 4 carts and 8 oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. But he did not give any to the sons of Gohath, because theirs was a service of the holy objects, which they carried on the shoulder. Why is this important if we fast forward into 2 Samuel 6 with Uzzah? Uzzah, he touched it. Shouldn't have touched it. I told you not to touch it. I told you not to touch it, and you touched it. But they were carrying the ark with carts. Now, you think, well, why are you supposed to do that, David? You know, even the Nazis in the movies know that you're not supposed to carry it with a cart. It's Indiana Jones. The first one, okay, just, where's this guy going with this? So it's written, you're not supposed to do that. Here's where they got the cart idea. Now, remember what it says in the text, according to their service. So one family group was supposed to carry all the fabric of the tent. The other family group was supposed to carry all the structure, the folding poles, let's say, and everything that goes with setting up the tent, which are probably a little bit less complicated than the ones we use today. But anyway, so they are the ones that carry those things. That's why they needed the carts. But everything else that's holy, that's consecrated specifically for the use of the tabernacle, is supposed to be carried on the poles. And so this plays a part. So if you want to write down 2 Samuel 6, verse 3 and verse 6, plays a part in the story there with Uzzah in 2 Samuel 6. And so now it's kind of interesting as we go through this, the prehistory, you know, of all the what happened in the rest of the history of Israel. You go back to the very beginning, and you start seeing, oh, that's why they did that. Oh, that's what happened. It's sort of like Marvel Comics, you know, they give us the backstory of everything. And so here we're getting the backstory of a lot of the history. Here's how they should have done it. Here's what they should have done, and instead they did it not according to the pattern. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Now here we have the rest of this chapter gets sort of repetitive. If you kind of skim over this chapter, it gets a little bit repetitive. We're going to look at what happens here. So now every leader, remember we talked about the leaders of each tribe. And so every leader, beginning with the tribe of Judah, Nahshon, which we said earlier was is a descendant or part of the lineage of Christ. Here now, the leaders in verse 10 says, the leaders offered the dedication of the offering for the altar when it was anointed. So the leaders offered for their offering before the altar. The Lord said to Moses, let them present their offering one leader each day. So one leader each day was to give an offering. So this is going to take how many days? 12 days. 12 days. I know it's early. Some of you may not have had enough caffeine. But so this is going to take 12 days. Now the one who presented the offering on the first day was Nahshon, the son of Amminadab, which the names in these are just quite awesome as far as trying to pronounce them, of the tribe of Judah. And he offered, and his offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. Ugh. Sally collected seashells on the sea. According to the shekel of the sanctuary. Okay? So this is a specific unit of measurement. And so it gives us that specific unit. And that is about one shekel, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, is about half an ounce. About half an ounce. So if we have 130 shekels, divide that in half, what is that? 65 shekels, or 65 ounces. How much is silver going for on the street, black market? Anybody know? Okay. I don't know either. You can probably Google it. But, I mean, that's a massive amount. Nobody's carrying around that amount of... Okay, so this is a rather large bowl, okay? And according to the shekel, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Nahshon, the son of Amminadab. And so here, this repeats 12 times. Okay, every day there's this offering. Okay, now I do not believe that it was just him that offered this. It was something that was gathered from the tribe itself for this offering. It represented an offering from the tribe, and so every tribe offered this amount for the use of the Israelites. Remember, they were. We're going to get to this in a second. No, just for this 12 days before they left. They did this. And so this was just kind of initial. This was, again, this was for an offering, a dedication of the altar when it was anointed. So this was a specific dedication purpose. And so this is what they did. And so, you go through and you see, you can kind of circle. I just kind of circle in my notes, third day, fourth day, so I can divide this chapter out. That's just me. You can do it however you want to. And again, verse 84, towards the end of this chapter, this was the dedication offering for the altar from the leaders of Israel when it was anointed. And so in verse 84, it gives us the sum of everything that was offered, the total tally of everything that's offered. And the language in this, as you read through Numbers, the language is very specific. It doesn't leave a whole lot of room for doubt as to what's being counted in that thing. And so it gets very specific, 84 to 88. this is the sum of the offering. If you want to just mark that there in your notes. Verse 89 gives us something that's pretty interesting. Verse, the last section here. Now when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the ark of the testimony, from between the two cherubim. So he spoke to him. So Moses goes in. Who's speaking? God. The mercy seat. This is something that's used throughout the Old Testament. This concept of God speaking from the mercy seat. This is his throne on earth between the two cherubim. Okay, if you want to look at Exodus 25, 21 and 22. Exodus 25, it says, you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony which I will give to you. There I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are upon the ark of the testimony, I will speak to you about all that I will give you in commandment for the sons of Israel. So that's where you come to be with God. Is at the mercy seat. And so Moses goes to and God speaks from the mercy seat. Also Psalm 80 verse 1, Psalm 80 verse 1, and then Psalm 99 verse 1, David talks about, or the psalmist writes about God being enthroned above the cherubim. Enthroned above the cherubim. And so this is that concept of God being in his place. God being with them. The very presence of God. That's a very powerful concept. They were the only ones on the planet that had that. And I think if you could see the cloud, you could know that the very physical presence in that concept, that part of God was on the mercy seat. Could you not at least feel a little bit of pride in the fact that we are God's chosen people? Can you kind of see where that would come from? You could see where that would try and, you know, elevate you above the rabble, and we'll talk about the rabble here shortly. So here they are, the ones that are chosen by God. Now, that is not to say that they were the only ones that knew anything about God. You mean, who's Jethro? Do you remember Jethro? The father-in-law of Moses. I'm not talking about the Clampets, okay? We're talking about the father-in-law of Moses. Some of you have no idea what I'm just talking about. So they knew about God. They had a relationship with God. We see earlier that Jethro offered a sacrifice to God. It's not that they were the only ones that had a relationship with God, but they were the only ones that had this close relationship with God in this way. But they were also the only ones that had to live to this kind of standard to be consecrated to God in this way. And so it really sets them apart from other people at that time. It's really easy for us to think that, you know, we get so focused on, this is a small, in the global scheme of things, this is a small group of people who have the physical presence of God with them. The rest of the globe should still be following the patriarchal system. The rest of the globe should be still following the same kind of thing that Abraham did, okay? We know from history that they don't necessarily do that, okay? But that's what they should be doing. What's interesting, historically, any of you have heard of the Code of Hammurabi or something like that? Hammurabi, how you? Okay. It's very similar to the principles of God. And so some have said, well, you know, it's just a standard common thing that people believed back then. Not necessarily. What if God told them what they needed to believe? So that really, we need to think, when we read through the Old Testament, we're reading about a specific people, not the rest of the globe. It kind of puts things in perspective. And so here they are. They're the ones that have the mercy seat. They're the ones that have the presence of God in this way. And Moses goes in to talk to them. And so chapter 8, we talk about seven lamps. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and say to him," "Speak to Aaron and say to him, when you mount the lamps, the seven lamps will give light in front of the lampstand." Aaron therefore did so. He mounted its lamps at the front of the lampstand, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now this was a workmanship of the lampstand, hammered work of gold from its base to its flowers. It was hammered work, according to the pattern which the Lord had shown Moses. So he made the lampstand. According to the pattern. Does that mean anything theologically? According to the pattern? What does that mean? What does that give us? Direction? Instruction? A design, right? I mean, that should just make you just feel all warm and gushy inside. When God, here's a pattern, okay? Here's a pattern that we follow. Theologically, are there people that say, well, you can just kind of do whatever you want to do and just whatever you feel, and God doesn't care. But here's a pattern, according to the pattern. Exodus chapter 25, verses 9 and 31. They did everything according to the pattern that was given to them on the mountain, okay? Look over in Acts chapter 7. So that was Exodus 25, 9 and 31, if you're writing the notes down. Now we're going to go to Acts chapter 7. Verse 14. Or I'm sorry, 44. Who writes these notes anyway? Man, can't even read them. Acts 7:44. Remember, this is Stephen and his preaching. "Our fathers had the tabernacle of testimony in the wilderness, just as he who spoke to Moses directed him to make it according to the pattern which he had seen." Okay, here's again confirmation that the things that were done at that time were done according to the pattern, just as God had given them. Acts chapter 7, verse 44. Then we look over at Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5. Sometimes I don't give you guys the verse, because you guys with like the phones or your tablet get there before I do. And so I hang on to that. It's a control thing, okay? It's a control thing. Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5. Let's begin with verse 4. "Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all," speaking of Jesus, "since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law." Remember, Jesus was from what tribe? Judah. And the priests were from what tribe? Levi. Now, every priest was a Levite, but not every Levite was a priest. Okay, there were specific groups, but Jesus wasn't from that tribe. And so, from the law, in verse 5, "who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle. So, for see," he says, "that you make all things according to the pattern which was shown you on the mountain." And so now we talk about we're given a more excellent ministry with Christ, in that it's different. It's not according to, we now have the heavenly concept. We don't have the earthly concept, okay? But according to the pattern. And look over at Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3. He's not giving us the verses yet. 16 and 17. "However, let us keep living by the same standard to which we have attained. Brethren, join in following my example and observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us." Is a pattern important? How many of you have tried to make anything just kind of just feel it out. You don't really try and use numbers and rulers, protractors, whatever. I'm just going to feel this out, and I want it to be a perfect square. It doesn't work, does it? You need something to help you out with. And so this, God gives us a pattern. This is what I want. This is what I want you to copy. This is what you need to do. And Philippians here says, here's what you're supposed to do. Here's people who are doing it right. And you need to copy them. And you need to copy the pattern that's given to us. That should make us feel good inside. That we should be copying a specific rule or pattern instead of just doing whatever we want. Because if we start doing whatever we want, then there's no standard, right? There's no standard. And then God becomes a respecter of persons, which he is not. And so a pattern. And so they followed according to the pattern that was given to them. And then the rest of chapter 8, we begin to see the cleansing of the Levites. This is rather interesting. In verse 5, again the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the Levites from among the sons of Israel and cleanse them. Thus you shall do to them for their cleansing. Sprinkle purifying water on them. Let them use a razor over their whole body and wash their clothes. And so there's this whole cleansing process that they were supposed to go through for the Levites, because they were going to be gods, all right? And so he takes them the bull and grain offering in verse 8. And he said in verse 9, so you shall present the Levites before the tent of the meeting. You shall also assemble the whole congregation of the sons of Israel and present the Levites before the Lord. So if they're presenting the Levites before the Lord, which side of the tabernacle do you think they're going to be on? The east side. Why? So the door is, right? That's the entrance. And so you're presenting them before the tabernacle on the east side before the Lord. And the sons of Israel, this is kind of interesting, verse 10, and the sons of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites. It was as though Israel was offering or giving them to the Lord. Because the Levites, looking over here in verse 12, now the Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of the bulls. And the bulls become that offering, the offering that actually dies. But the Levites were consecrated for the use of God. That's pretty powerful. I think just the imagery there that you don't lay hands on just anything. So they laid hands ceremonially on the Levites, and the Levites took and laid their hands ceremonially on the bulls. And the bulls were the ones that were sacrificed, but the Levites were for the use of the Lord. In verse 14, thus you shall separate the Levites from among the sons of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine. They are mine. Here is the consecration of the Levites to God for his specific use. You couldn't use a Levite for just any old thing, okay? They were consecrated unto the Lord. Now read 1 Peter chapter 2, 9 and 10. First Peter chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. Does that make that a little bit more clear? A little bit more important? Now, when you read that without the background, and so Peter was what? Nationality-wise, he was a Jew, right? So he understood what that meant. And so when we read this and we see that the Levites were consecrated unto God for his use, they were washed clean and presented before the Lord. When were you washed clean? Ceremonially. At baptism. According to the pattern. And so here we are ceremonially, in a way, as a royal priesthood before God Almighty. Does that make you feel good inside? It should. It should. But that's what we get when we get to compare the Old Testament with the New Testament concepts. Over and over again, we'll see how this overlaps and how this works. And here we are being consecrated. The Levites are consecrated for the use of God. I think that's just so powerful. And again, in verse 21, let the Levites, too, purify themselves from sin and wash their clothes. Again, this concept of being ceremonial clean for the use of God. Now, this is an interesting clause in verse 23. Now, the Lord spake to Moses, saying, this is what applies to the Levites from 25 years old and upward. They shall enter to perform service in the work of the tent of meeting. But at the age of 50 years, they shall retire from service in the work and not work anymore. And they may, however, assist their brothers in the tent of meeting to keep an obligation, but they themselves shall do no work. Thus you shall deal with the Levites according to their obligations. So when do the Levites retire? What age? 50. That's a pretty good gig, right? Now, you retire from your service in the tabernacle. It doesn't mean you don't do anything anymore, but you retire from your service in the tabernacle. And he adds this clause in there that if they want to go up and kind of help the youngsters out, they can every once in a while, but you know that's not their job. They don't need to actually work. Could you see somebody wanting to go up? You've done this for 25 years. You've gone up to the temple. Now you have this new group of youngsters coming in, and they're sort of wet behind the ears. They don't know what they're doing. And so you have so that's kind of neat that this clause is left in there for that transition period. That if they want to see and kind of make sure they can still go up there, but they're not supposed to do any work. The new guys are supposed to be the ones doing the work. I think that's rather interesting. Chapter 9. What heading do you have with chapter 9? Passover. This is Passover numero dos. This is the second time they've done the Passover in chapter 9 here. And so this is literally a year after they've left out of Egypt, right? After the mass exodus. Okay, and so thus the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai on the first month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, now let the sons of Israel observe the Passover at its appointed time. On the 14th day of the month of this month, at twilight you shall observe it. At the appointed time you shall observe it according to all its statutes and according to all its ordinances. Again, this concept of a pattern is reinforced. Do it the right way. You can't just do it however you want to do it. You can't be willy-nilly about these kind of things. You got to do it the way you're supposed to do it. Okay? And so they observed the Passover. And then in verse 9, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if any one of you or of your generations becomes unclean because of... So again, we're adding here some clauses to the observance of the Passover. Okay? Because in verse 6, it tells us, but there were some men who were unclean because of the dead person, so they could not observe the Passover on that day. So they came before Moses and Aaron on that day, and it says, though in verse 7, though we are unclean because of the dead person, why are we restrained from presenting the offering of the Lord at its appointed time? And so Moses, or God, spoke and said, if any one of you or of your generations to come, and so this becomes a lasting thing. This is not just a one-time exception. This becomes a lasting statute. He says, it becomes unclean as a dead person or is on a distant journey. He may, however, observe the Passover to the Lord in the second month of the 14th day of the twilight. They shall observe it. They shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs, and they do it like they're supposed to. 13 is interesting. But the man who is clean and is not on a journey and yet neglects to observe the Passover, that person shall be cut off from his people, for he did not present the offering of the Lord at its appointed time. That man will bear his sin. Huh. Is it human nature to just shrug things off sometimes? I don't feel like it. I don't want to do the whole bitter herbs thing this year. It kind of gives me a little bit of, my tummy hurts. Or whatever, okay? So God is saying here, if you're able to do it and you don't, it's not good. Bad news bears for that guy, okay? If an alien sojourns with you, who is an alien? Are we talking about extraterrestrials? Stranger. Stranger is another translation. If a stranger sojourns among you and observes the Passover to the Lord according to the statute of the Passover, according to its ordinance, so he shall do. You shall have one statute both for the alien and for the native of the land. And so that everybody's supposed to do it the same way. If a stranger comes in to do it and you have friends that are traveling or whatever, we'll get to this. I don't know. We'll see. But there's some rabble that is with them, some people that were not among the tribes, but also left Exodus with them. If they wanted to participate with them, they had to do it according to the statutes also. Now, beginning of verse 15, we start talking about the cloud on the tabernacle. Exodus chapter 40 gives us, Exodus chapter 40 verses 36 and 37 gives us, talks about it being the presence of God. Exodus chapter 40 verses 36 and 37. And it says in verse 15, "Now on the day that the tabernacle was erected, the cloud covered the tabernacle, the tent of the testimony, and in the evening it was like the presence appearance of fire over the tabernacle until morning. So it was continuously." So you had a cloud by day and as fire by night. And so it was continuously. The cloud would cover it by day and the appearance of fire by night. Whenever, in verse 17, whenever the cloud was lifted from over the tent, after the sons of Israel would then set out. And in the place where the cloud settled down, there the sons of Israel would camp. So you're seeing what's going to happen here? So if they wake up in the morning, they stretch, do their morning yoga, whatever they do in the morning, and they look up and the cloud's gone, then what happens? It's time to move. We're going to move, and we're going to move to where the cloud now is. Okay? And so this gives them direction. God says it's time for us to move, and they move. And at the commandment of the Lord, verse 18, the sons of Israel would set out, and they would, it gets quite repetitive, and set out at the commandment of the Lord, they would camp. As long as the cloud settled over the tabernacle, they remained camped. Down here, in verse 22, it says, "Whether it was 2 days or a month or a year that the cloud lingered over the tabernacle, staying above it, the sons of Israel remained camped and did not set out. But when it was lifted, they would set out. At the commandment of the Lord, they camped, and at the commandment of the Lord, they set out. They kept the Lord's charge according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses." And so this gives us two things. One, God was in control, all right? God was in control of where they went, when they went, how they went, okay? And then second, this gives us sort of the chain of command here. They kept the Lord's charge according to the commandment of the Lord through Moses. So Moses was their go-between guy. This chain of command. We did not get near far enough. How do they know when they're supposed to leave? How do they know when they're supposed to go? Chapter 10 gives us the silver trumpets. They fashioned silver trumpets, and they were to blow them at a certain way, and they would know when they were to leave out. If you want to write Psalm 81, verses 3 through 4, I'd go back and read that psalm. It's pretty interesting talking about these kind of things we're talking about this morning with the silver trumpets. Psalm 81, verses 3 through 4. So that you will know that I am the Lord your God. This is why they had the trumpets. In chapter 10 through verse 10 is everything that happens at the base of Mount Sinai. Okay, and so chapter 10 verse 11 begins another section here where they depart from Sinai. Okay, chapter 10 through the end of the chapter. All the events that had happened there from Exodus 19 until Numbers 10. If you want to write here beside number or wilderness 10:10, all the events from Exodus 19 until this chapter happened at the base of Mount Sinai. It was about 11 months and 20 days. And you see here that verse 3, when both are blown, all the congregation shall gather themselves at the doorway. If only one is blown, then the leaders, the heads of the divisions, shall assemble. But when you blow an alarm, the camp shall be pitched on the east side and shall set out. Okay, so it begins to give us how they do this. Verse 8, the priestly sons of Aaron, moreover, shall blow the trumpets, and this shall be for you a perpetual statute throughout your generations. And so who can blow the trumpets? The sons of Aaron, okay? The sons of Aaron can do that. Now, what is also interesting is that on the Ark of Triumph of Tiberius that conquered Jerusalem in AD 70, he has on that ark pictures of the lampstand, hammered out according to the pattern, pictures of the ark, and pictures of two silver trumpets, or two trumpets. It's, you know, it's stone, so you can't tell what color it is, but it's two trumpets on that Ark of Triumph. And so where did these things go after they were conquered? After Jerusalem was conquered in AD 70 by the Romans, they went to Rome. And there they were lost to antiquity. But it's interesting that we can see those things. So here that we see they were made, here's where their original use. And a long time later, we see them on in AD 70. Remember, this is 1406, 1400 before Christ. So we're talking almost 1,500 years later, we see him again on that ark, or on that Arch of Triumph. Any questions, comments as we close? All right, we're going to pick up here next Sunday, and we're going to leave Mount Sinai, and we're going to close this chapter out at Mount Sinai. Thank you very much for your attention.